Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 36 for August 15th, 2008. CouchDB. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much.
Well, I'm sitting here with Jan Lennon, who has agreed to talk with me for a few minutes about CouchDB. Hello, Jan.
Hello, Randall.
Hi. So we're here at OSCON, and I understand you had a presentation earlier this week to talk about CouchDB.
Yeah, that was on Wednesday, and it was pretty well received.
And so give us a background. What is CouchDB about?
The DB in CouchDB stands for database, obviously.
Okay.
When people think, hear database, they mean relational database, like MySQL, Oracle, these kinds of types of databases. CouchDB is not a relational database, so that's a fundamental different approach to the data storage model.
So a relational database is if we have something that has tables, that have columns, and we do things like joins to get from one set of tables to another, and everything's pretty rectangular, in other words.
Correct.
So how does CouchDB differ from that?
When you come from the programming side, you usually have some data objects in your programs that represent a data record, maybe an address entry, a person, a blog post, something like that. And you have it's a single entity within your program. And in CouchDB, you can just stick that into the database. With a relational database, you have to go through some layer, often an object relational mapper kind of library, that will split up your data object into all the tables and make sure that the joins are correct. And that there's a lot of work going on to make the data we use when programming and the data that's actually stored in the database. And with CouchDB, you just take the data object and store it as it is into the database.
So in other words, if I had a record about a person, and I had like a name and an address and a city and a state, I could have like the name be like one element of this and the address as a complex structure all as a second element then?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so instead of having to, like what we do normally with, say, an SQL-type database, like a MySQL or Postgres or something,
yep.
We would have to take that and make columns for, like, the address and the city and the state and the zip and the love like that.
That, or we would separate that out into an addresses table and point to that, make that work with references.
So this is a different approach. Is it a novel approach? Is this something people have done before?
This is something people have done before. That's ultimately, the storage model that Lotus Notes or the database of Lotus Notes uses.
Ah.
That's where the influence comes from.
Okay, so what niche is this filling? What's the problem space that someone would look to CouchDB to solve?
Okay, the idea here is that most data we use today is not inherently relational. Like, we have this Web 2.0 kind of sites where people just put in all their crap,
mm-hmm.
and that by no means does fit in any relational database, just not rectangular, like you say.
Yeah.
So the data we use today everywhere, that just fits naturally into CouchDB. And where relational databases are used today because they're proof of technology, there's nothing wrong with relational databases, but the storage model is probably not ideal for the type of applications we have today. So it's probably not the niche we're talking about here.
Okay, so I would look to CouchDB if I was working with data that had sort of not square shapes, in other words,
right,
like not 10,000 records that all look the same.
Right. That we call them that semi-structured data.
Semi-structured.
Like,
okay.
If you look at like address records, if you want to store business cards, then on my business, like if you, in my real world business cards, I don't have a fax machine, but I don't. At the same time, I don't have a field fax and then a value null on my business card. It just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So. But if your business card does have a fax number on it, that's totally okay, and you can just have two different objects within your database.
So in CouchDB, I could have different objects that have different sets of fields.
Right.
So how would I, as a programmer, then figure out whether it has the field or not? Is there an API that can give me the data that's there? How does that work?
Okay. There are two. two ways to get your data back. When you store a thing into an object into CouchDB, the CouchDB term is document. We call ourselves a document-based or document-oriented database.
Okay.
So you create a document that holds all the values that you had in your object. And when you put that into CouchDB, you get back a key. And when you hand the key to CouchDB, you get back all the data. Just a very simple concept.
Okay.
But there's also the thing we call views. That's a way to get a lot of documents that are in a database, either in a certain order, like ordered by name or by date or something. They can also filter out everything that starts with A or with B or from last year.
So I could have, for example, if I had a document that included many many addresses, for example, or like a contact list, then I could ask for all the people that live in Oregon.
Yes.
And so that would be what you call a view.
Yes.
How am I programming this? What's my language? Obviously not SQL. So right. what am I interfacing to this with?
The actual data that we store is a JSON format.
JSON. So that's the JavaScript object notation.
Right. Okay. Which is no longer tied to the JavaScript language.
Yes.
So it's very easy to use everywhere. And to program views, we borrowed the concept that makes Google so famous. That's MapReduce.
MapReduce, yeah.
Yeah. So, as a programmer, you write two functions: a map function and a reduce function, and provide them to CouchDB in a special manner. And then CouchDB knows, okay, this is a view. And when somebody queries this view, the document that are in your database get passed to these two functions and evaluate all the things, and then you get a table with the results.
So the CouchDB engine runs this function that you've provided,
correct,
and part of it is about selecting records, and part of it is about like just getting the pieces that you're interested of or some calculation based on those.
That's totally correct. And the language there we use, the default language is JavaScript.
JavaScript,
because it just
fits
very naturally, and it's the language that's at least the SpiderMonkey implementation we use, that's the Mozilla JavaScript language, it's very well embeddable.
Okay.
And maybe Lua is another good candidate to put in there. The interface we use there is a plugin interface, so you can actually put in any any other query language there. So if you want to write your map and reduce function, Python, Ruby, Java, that's perfectly possible. But these languages tend to be not as good as embeddable as JavaScript. So that's a trade-off there.
They would need to have the notion of like an arbitrary dictionary or hash of data and then some way to do calculations on those probably.
Yeah. That's not... probably not the hard problem, but they need to make sure that you, for example, if a document gets passed to a map function, the map function cannot change this object. And in JavaScript, you can see on the interpreter level, you can say seal this object. You can it's read only, and it's possible in other languages too. But in JavaScript, it's just there. It's just a flag you set. We are done.
Okay, so this, how long has this project been around?
Depends on how you look at it. I think it started development 4.5 years ago, and it was pretty not known except for a few blog posts for about 2 years of its development.
Was it called CouchDB from the beginning?
Yes.
Okay.
And
what was the project that triggered it? What was going on?
Oh, okay, the history.
Yeah.
The guy behind CouchDB did all of the design and by far most of the implementations, Damien Katz.
Okay.
And he used to work on the Lotus Notes database.
Ah.
He's this core database engineer, really, really hardcore guy, a very nice person too.
Mm-hmm.
And he started prototyping. The story is he worked on the Notes database and he thought this is pretty nice, but we kind of need to bring it to the new century. Like Notes is 20, 25 years old as well. There's a lot of craft there. And
right.
He basically thought, oh, we'll do Notes right without all the legacy crap. So he started. He quit his job. He lived in Boston by the time, had a wife and a newborn daughter. Quit his job, moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, where it's rather cheap to live. His family's from there, so they support there. And he lived off his savings for 2 years to build CouchDB.
Wow.
In the support of his family.
What did he start with, it being an open source product to begin with? Or was this a commercial thing that he was originally starting with?
As far as I remember, he didn't really think, he just wanted to build something cool.
Oh, okay.
So he just started with that. And
all right.
When he had something, he looked at how to get it open, and he originally released it as a GPL project.
Okay.
The prototype of CouchDB was done in C++, and he's a real badass programmer in C++. But along the way, or halfway through, he discovered Erlang, which is a different kind of language. That's targeted, I don't know, server applications maybe, and you saw that it's a perfect fit for CouchDB, so you rewrote the entire thing in Erlang, and that about around then he released it as a GPL project, and not far after that I got hold of the project and started contributing.
Okay, now Erlang, just describe that for people who don't know what Erlang is.
Oh, Erlang is this.
And you only have an hour.
Oh crap. Let me see. Okay, Erlang was developed, it's a research project from Ericsson. Ericsson is this telco company. They make these telephones, which that all of us use every day.
Yes.
And they have, they had back in the ages, a research lab in Stockholm, Sweden, where they just employed a couple of computer scientists with the job of solving the telecommunication problem, just in a general way. That's what they had, a blank plate there, and just need to a blank table there, and could work with that. What they came up with after 10, 15 years of research was Erlang. The problem they faced back then, they need to have reliable software guaranteed to be reliable, massively concurrent. That is, you have a piece of hardware, there are 10,000 telephone calls going through. It doesn't have to be a problem there. Mm-hmm. They support, I don't know, hundreds of gigabytes per second on these machines. And one paramount requirement there is, if there's a problem with one of the telephone calls, there might be a problem with the software or with the connection or anything. If there's a problem, by no means that it must not be possible that this problem affects any of the other currently running process.
Okay.
And the Erlang programming model is built around just that, having a lot of concurrent but very isolated processes that do a lot of jobs in parallel, but in a way that they can't interfere with each other. That is conceptually a little bit different from how, for example, threads work. They help you to do things in parallel, but they have a shared global state where things can go wrong and will go wrong.
Yes.
So that's a different approach there. And there's, I don't know, I could go on about it for an hour, I guess.
Well, that's good. The advent of multi-core machines has probably brought Erlang back to the forefront for programming.
Right. That's where I was getting to. This telco software and hardware problem they had 20 years ago and solved, we now in the web world have the same problem. Like back in the days, you had a single computer, single big database, had some random queries. Now 10,000 people update their Twitter status 24/7 all mm-hmm. the time.
That's only when it's up, though.
When it's up. Or they go to pounds or whatever. Right. When they're... Yeah, so this is in conceptually a very similar problem, and they have this extremely great toolkit to solve these problems. Erlang is open source, very controlled by Ericsson because they make a lot of money from it, but it is open source. They see an advantage there. And we can just use that and leverage all the cool, like I said, 20 years of extremely well research.
So Erlang was chosen to be the rewrite language for this. Then you came on board. Were you an Erlang programmer already?
No, not at all. I'm a web developer by trade. That's where I still make my money. And I saw, CouchDB might make my life a lot easier.
Okay.
And so I got interested. And it was Windows only at the time because Damien used to work on Windows there. He writes cross-platform code, but it's just happened to be his platform then.
Sure.
And I'm a everything but Windows person.
Okay.
I want to use it on my Mac, so I started porting it to Unix and started writing a build system so I could play with it. And then I just stuck around, worked on every aspect there. That was around 2 years ago. And about a year ago, I started looking into Erlang. So I'm not actually an Erlang expert or anything.
But you're finding Erlang reasonable to learn and able to make changes to the code and have some confidence that they're going to work and that sort of thing?
Yes. Erlang is... the only drawback, not the only, but one of the drawbacks of Erlang is it has a very weird syntax. So if somebody looks at it, like, oh, it looks like crap, I don't understand it, I don't want to use it. But once you get past it, I figured out when I really started working with it seriously, I think it took half a day to a day to get over the syntax thing and then to see how the other things that are so beautifully in the Erlang runtime and language to use that you just don't care about the syntax. It could be even worse. You wouldn't care because you can do so amazing things with it.
Some people say the same thing about Perl. Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm very familiar with this problem, yes.
Yeah.
So you're one of the developers now. How many other people are working on CouchDB today?
Okay, there's Damien, who's fortunate enough to be allowed to work full time on it.
Okay.
There's me working in my spare time, Christopher Lenz of Trek, the Python subversion web client kind of thing.
He's okay.
Very famous in that regard. He works in his spare time, where he's got a new kit now, so that's a little of the spare time. And there's Noah Slater from the UK, who's our auto tools build kind of guy.
Okay.
And looking after the project release management and all this. So there are four people who have commit access. We've got around five people who occasionally send in patches and have suggestions and report books, and they are very, very supportive and helpful mm-hmm. and try things out. And another 10 people who actively develop things on top of Couch and find problems and report them, and all of them also help out with the documentation wiki and all that.
So Damien's doing this full time?
Yes.
And how is he supporting himself? What's his business model that has him do this full time?
IBM hired him to work full time on CouchDB.
Oh, well, that would be an advantage. Yes.
Yes. That was a rather funny story. When he ran out of money after two, and he didn't run out of money, but he needed a new job, and he worked for MySQL for half a year, and with the upcoming 5.2 release, they have ported MySQL to the libevent library to do threading a little bit better, and he didn't come up with the idea, but he did the implementation eventually. So when 5.2 MySQL gets deployed, the internet will get around 30% faster. That's
nice.
Because of work Damien did while he was there.
Oh, very good.
And he did a little bit of CouchDB work on the side. MySQL was okay with that. And then IBM approached him and said, "Yo, Damien, we want you to work on CouchDB full time." Damien said, "Well, I know you guys are good guys. We work together. I know you, but there's no way in that I give you CouchDB. There's no amount of money. I put so much love and effort into it. I can't give you CouchDB." And they went back again. No. A week later, not really a week, but they came back again. "But Damien, we want you to work full-time on CouchDB, and we donate everything you do to the Apache Software Foundation."
Ah.
And Damien said, "I don't know." "And you get a raise." Okay.
Yeah, there we go. Because IBM was already working heavily with Apache for the products that they had, right?
Yeah.
So the Apache Foundation seemed like a natural fit for that.
Right. Sam Ruby works for IBM. He's like has his fingers in a lot of open source projects, and he saw the value in CouchDB and made this happen.
Wow.
That's pretty amazing. So imagine Damien's position. You start this open source project. IBM comes along and asks you if he can pay you for it. That's
very nice. It's very nice. So apparently it was useful to IBM. What do you think IBM saw in it at that point? What problems was it solving for them?
I don't think they are actually considering, or they were at that point, they weren't considering using it actually for anything they would do.
They just randomly picked people to pay? That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Thank you, IBM.
Damien is with the CTO's office as well. I don't know all the details, but here there's a research kind of budget he works off. So
okay.
they are obviously interested in like how does it work with mail and with notes, and I don't actually know what's going on within IBM.
Okay. There,
and Damien can't really share that, but they are not actively like, how can we replace the notes database with CouchDB also?
Oh, so they were really just buying him for their other research, and they.
He's doing CouchDB only.
Wow. Okay.
And they might want to look into integration, but I think they see potential in CouchDB and just want to have a stake in the project.
Ah. Okay.
So then, yeah.
Now you said that originally the project was under the GPL license, but Apache's license is different. It's under the Apache license now.
It's the Apache 2.0 license.
Okay. So this is something that can be integrated into a product without having to reveal your own source code if you set it alongside and integrate it somehow.
Right. At the time Damien released it, it made perfect sense to put the GPL, to use the GPL, because CouchDB is a really competitive advantage if you really look at it.
Sure.
So to protect this, he had to use the GPL, and it was a good tool to do that.
Sure.
With the Apache Software Foundation in the back now, that doesn't really apply anymore. So.
Okay. Works well. So this is the kind of tool that I would put typically on a website. Would it be for being the back-end database for a website? Would I use it in other applications besides web, or is web kind of the primary target?
The primary target was sort of the original design. modeled it after Nodes. So Nodes has this replication feature where you can take an entire database application offline, work with it with the live data, and then go back to a master database and replicate things back. Think of a company consultant kind of setup. The consultant can go to the client, work with the client, where there's, oh, back in the day there were no internet connections, but now there might be internet connections, but the client might not use them, and let you use them if you're, for example, at Apple.
Yeah.
Or you're on a plane or at a hotel where it's supremely expensive to buy internet, where it doesn't make sense. So you have this offline application as you saw, that has a copy of the database that you work on, and the changes can get replicated back and forth when you get online.
Like people reading mail offline. So I would connect up to my server for a while. I would synchronize my mail,
and then I would
read my mail offline, not have to be paying for internet time, or maybe I'm on the airplane where it's not possible.
Right. With the little twist that it also works if you've got 1,000 consultants reading the single mailbox or the single database.
Wow.
So, or any number, really.
So there's some smarts in there that kind of figure out how to do the sync properly when it all comes back together then.
Right. And that's one of the things that Nodes got right. I'm not a Nodes expert, so I might not be right there. But that's one of the things that Nodes got right, and that's this replication is in CouchDB as well. So the original design was to support this kind of offline, take your data with you kind of applications. Turns out this is just a very special problem of the general problem data synchronization. When you look at high traffic websites, you don't have a single server. You have at least one more server in case the first one dies.
Right. You have to have failover. You have to be able to have something that high availability, they call it, where one goes down, the next one can take that and pick up the speed.
Right. And you need to have these data sort of synchronized so nobody notices.
Right.
If you've got a lot of write and read requests, you might want to do load balancing, put all data on multiple machines and serve for multiple machines.
Sure.
That's the same synchronization again.
So again, we're talking about something like Twitter, where everybody is posting updates to their Twitter feeds, but you can't do it all on one machine. You have to have multiple machines that act as web front ends. You also probably have to have multiple database replications. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
So this would be for something like that.
Right. Well, Twitter is a special case that everybody has an opinion on.
Well, I think it's the thing that most of us identify with, because when it's down, it affects all of us now. So, right. So in this situation, then you would have multiple instances then of the CouchDB engine. You call it what is it, server?
It's a server.
Okay. So would there be a CouchDB server right next to every web server, or would you centralize those a bit, or how would that normally look in an architecture?
It depends. you can build pretty much every architecture there. With MySQL, you're better off having a centralized server and spread out to a couple of slaves to spread read load. If you want to do write load handling, you want to partition your data.
Mm-hmm.
With CouchDB, you can have multiple master servers at the same time. MySQL replication running on multiple master setup is kind of tricky. It's possible, but probably not the way you want to deal with it, or the problems that come with it are kind of.
There's a lot of tough problems that result when you get multiple masters. Yeah,
right. And if you think about the client server or the consultant company setup we had earlier, this is basically a master, an end master setup, and you can just use that setup on a web as well.
Right.
So if you can deal with the fact that before replication occurs, replication is not a continuous thing, but you trigger replication and then database gets synchronized. If you can live with the fact that the all of your data nodes will be only eventually consistent, that's the how the experts call it, that they're not it's not enforced that they are consistent at all times, but there might be a little delay. You have that with the traditional MySQL master client,
multi-master server.
Master slave.
Okay, sure.
Replication. There's a little delay there. You can optimize a lot of things there, but your application already needs to be aware that there might be a little delay. So.
Right.
That's the same.
Which, again, for like Twitter would be okay, because if you don't exactly get my most recent update when you fetch this particular web page, it's probably okay.
Yeah, if it takes another 20 seconds to get the latest tweet, I don't really care.
So does CouchDB work the same way then, or does CouchDB actually have synchronized updates to all the replications?
It's asynchronous.
So still asynchronous. So same sort of thing. So if I update it in one of my servers, I might not be seen by all the other servers quite yet.
Right, but they can then eventually pull the changes, integrate them.
Right. Is that something that's handled transparently by CouchDB, or do I need to trigger it from other things from the outside?
There, you need to trigger it from the outside, but you can set it up in the way that then it happens automatically, either with a cron drop, that's just the silliest, simple thing, but also you can have you can register for notifications to change in the CouchDB data store. So,
okay.
So again, you could, in theory, say, okay, a new change came in, trigger replication with these nodes. So there will be sort of...
Similar. So then on every update, something would get pushed to all the other slaves that are paying attention.
Yeah, you wouldn't obviously do it with every single update, but
that'd
every
be expensive.
10, every hundreds or so. But in theory, that way, that would work.
So what about scale? How big can I theoretically have a document and it not crawl to a grinding halt?
In theory, it doesn't matter, of course.
Well, yes.
But there are a couple of limitations. We're still in the phase of getting all the details right before getting them fast.
Sure.
And at the moment, everything works right. But if you put a really big document in there, you've got to... at the moment, it is cached in memory completely. So if your document bigger than memory, there will be paging, and that would be slow.
Ah, okay.
But there will be streaming access. So if you've got... just will get streamed through. And
so if we're talking something probably maybe, 5,000 names in a contact file, that's probably reasonable. But 500,000 might be pushing it a bit.
It might be, depends on how memory hungry the parser, the JSON parser is.
Okay.
And, one thing you can put into documents or associate with documents is attachments, just like email can have attachments.
Oh.
So the real big data would go in there.
Okay.
And there's a use case I can't really talk about where they want to put, binary data at the size of movies, DVD backup kind of things into attachments. And we are now working on, I did an API recently that made that a lot faster.
Like, say, if I was building a YouTube. Something like that,
yes.
Where I'd have to have it so people could upload things and there would be these large attachments. I wouldn't want that inside my CouchDB, but I want people to be able to search and query and cross-index the notes and comments about each of those things, but they want the large data somewhere else, something like that.
You could also put the data into CouchDB. What we will have eventually is a very thin layer on top of the file system that you can get, like with our Transparent API, or the big binary data as well.
So kind of like what blobs are for MySQL
and
Postgres.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Wow, that would make it even more interesting for stuff like that. And then you could have it on one shared network attached storage or something that would have the actual data in one replicated place.
Right. And at the moment, if we have two documents with the same attachment there, we store the attachment twice. So there's a possible performance increase to detect, okay, do we have that binary somewhere in place and just point to that. So these kinds of optimizations haven't been done yet.
Now, how did you... Okay, you said you were a web developer that stumbled across this. How did you become aware of it, and what made you decide to start playing heavily with it?
Okay, I think I read a blog by a friend of Damien's.
Okay.
That's Ned Batchelder of Tableau.
Okay.
Good, great guy. And he was, posting something about Damien. Then I followed Damien's blog for a while, and he was rambling about this document storage kind of thing and how cool Erlang is and whatever. And Damien occasionally writes very funny blog posts, so I was after that.
Ah.
And then I got hold of CouchDB. And then somebody else did a pretty nice review. That was Harry Fuchs from Zurich on SitePoint.com about CouchDB and how it may be used in the web world. And I thought, yes, that sounds pretty good. How I thought it would help me is when you design a web application, the first thing you do is spend a couple of days or weeks to design a database schema.
Right.
Find out where the indexes go, then look how to make queries fast.
Right.
And then you write your application, and 2 weeks in there's a change to the requirements, and you got to do it all over again. It's not, you don't have to do everything all over again, but effectively, you most of the time you deal with this. Details of relational data storage.
Mm-hmm.
The ORM systems we have make that a little easier, and migrations and Rails make that a little easier, but they are not really a solution to the problem that there's just a mismatch between philosophies of how to store data.
And because data has its own natural shape, and SQL databases require us to put everything in columns and rows.
Yeah, right. And I thought that was a silly... I finally realized that's a silly idea, and that I don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah, I've been looking at various object storage systems for Smalltalk, so a similar thing, yeah. Being able to just take the data in its natural shape and write it down, so I'm pretty familiar with that, too. So you came across this as a possible solution for your websites, and then you downloaded it and started playing with it?
Yeah, I started playing with it. I saw it doesn't work on my machine, made it work on my machine, then started playing with it.
And you're on OS X?
Yeah, I'm on OS X, yeah. I deploy on Linux and FreeBSD, but I work on OS X.
And what are you writing your websites in? What languages were you already experienced with?
I'm a long-term PHP guy. That's okay. Nothing to be, fond of these days, but I'm,
There's a heck of a lot of PHP code out there, though.
Yeah. I think I'm pretty good at it, so there's it doesn't make much sense just to throw this knowledge away, so I keep doing it.
Right.
But also, I dabbled with Python a lot. I do a lot of JavaScript. I love JavaScript.
Now, are you a freelancer, or were you working for a company?
Yeah, I work freelance.
Okay.
I have set it up sort of in a way that, one, I have a lot more small project where I do like the Ajax, make things flashy and use do Ajax to make really usable interface, not just flashy, but to enhance the user experience. I like that, but I also like doing the back-end scaling kind of things. And if I would have a single job just doing the scaling or just doing the Ajax stuff, I would be pretty bored.
Somebody has to keep changing roles a little bit.
Right. So I just set it up that I have a couple of projects to work on.
So how do you integrate CouchDB into a web application? What's the interface? Where does it connect? Okay. How do you deploy it? How does that work?
The only CouchDB API is a RESTful API.
Now, describe what a RESTful API is.
A RESTful API is it works over HTTP.
So a standard, a web request.
It is a standard web request that's web server built in CouchDB.
Okay.
And every object or document or view, everything in CouchDB is considered a resource, what they call in the REST world. And this resource has a URI, just as a web page.
Okay.
It has a unique address, and the database server has a server name. So if you look at HTTP server name, colon, port number, /, and then the resource directory, that's exactly the same how a CouchDB request looks like.
Okay.
So people who know how the web work just know how to use CouchDB. There's very little learning curve.
So I could actually hit a CouchDB server with a web browser?
Yes.
Would I see anything with that?
The built-in administration interface is just that.
Wow.
It serves static HTML pages and a bit of JavaScript to the browser. And if you hit CouchDB from the browser, you just see this administration interface. And if you want to work on the data, it just makes Ajax requests back to CouchDB to save the data.
Okay, so normally say I wanted to get everybody's addresses of people that lived in Oregon, I would first have to construct a view and upload that somehow.
Right. A view is, to create a view, you create a design document. It's just a regular document with a predefined structure and special naming.
Okay.
It's just a document. So you just put in a document and CouchDB knows this will be okay.
And I use the HTTP put call, is that what it is?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. So it's using the REST calls of get and put as being the fetching and storing of resources, okay.
There's get, put, post, and delete that we support, and head to just get conditional data.
Right.
That's just, if you've got a piece of data, you want to create it, you want to delete it, you want to update it, and that's another one, CRU, create, update, delete. You want to read it back. So this is the four basic operations for a single piece of data, and the get, put, post, delete, get, put, post, delete.
There's a mapping of 4 to 4. Who cares what they are? Okay, good.
It's just perfect and very, very simple.
So if I could then, because those calls, if I understand correctly, those calls are all supported by XHTTP requests from JavaScript.
In most browsers.
So if you have a browser compatibility issue, but let's set that aside for a moment. Like most modern browsers
while it is possible to do it from the browser, it might not be the best idea.
Okay.
So you could write applications that just run on CouchDB. That's actually a customer relationship management system, basically a reverse customer relationship management system where you, as the customer, have all your data, and then companies can come in and replicate pieces of data that you allow them to get.
Oh, okay.
And that works with CouchDB replication on your machine. It's a JavaScript-only application.
Right. So that would be, I can run my entire application in the browser, and it would simply be talking directly to CouchDB.
Right.
You're saying that's not the way a typical web application would use this.
Right. If you would do that, you would I have to make pretty sure that everything's very secure there. If you have the client directly talking to the database,
you usually don't
want to do that. So you have got some kind of middleware in there, Python, PHP, Java, whatever. Okay. And you would there, all these languages have libraries for making HTTP requests, and you basically write a very simple wrapper over your over the REST API, so you don't have to do the calls manually, but you make, I don't know, an object that you can just represent the database, you can fetch objects. And
so in terms of an architecture then, my browser is still making normal web page requests to some web server, and there's some code in there that you would write in Python or Perl or Ruby or whatever that then would talk this REST API back to CouchDB.
That's
where the fetching would happen. Yeah. What kind of security is there?
There's no security.
Oh, well, that's fun. Put your data on CouchDB and the world can see it.
Yes, we're very open in that regard.
Open data. I love it. The new open data movement.
The philosophy is we don't want to allow people to create walled gardens like Facebook or Twitter. Like I said, we are still in the phase of getting it right.
Okay.
And
I would imagine, though, that I could have a port restricted only to the local machine, for example. I have a bind to local host, for example.
Yes, that's possible already. Yeah. So you don't have to. You can do on the network level, you can make that happen. There might be ways, we haven't looked into it, to like client SSL certificate kind of things.
Basic auth, maybe? Could you use basic auth, or would that be crazy?
Maybe. What we will have is some sort of authentication and permission management system, but that's still in design phase, and we are not yet sure how we want that to work.
I mean, you probably at some point want the notion of different views for different users.
Right.
So you'd have to have some sort of user authentication system for that.
Right. But since CouchDB has an HTTP API, you can just put in a HTTP proxy in front of it that will do the authentication for you.
Right. So you would have you would say that the server itself is a trusted full access user, and then the server's code, the web server's code, would then be the thing that narrows down who can use it from the front end and what they can get access to.
Yeah, that's what's possible today and what people do that already deploy CouchDB.
Okay,
that works pretty well, and we kind of try to develop an outside of CouchDB system first to get a handle of how we want that to work actually before putting it in.
Sure. What's the performance like? I know you said you aren't starting on that, but is this already like the same speed as MySQL? Is it the same speed as typing it by hand? I mean, it's probably somewhere in between, but what's it feeling like so far?
It's pretty fast already.
Okay.
People are evaluating and get great numbers out of it, but we already know a lot of bottlenecks, and Damien says we can make it 100 times faster.
100 times faster,
yeah.
Wow.
The design and what comes with Erlang is we don't optimize that a single call is as fast as possible. That is what MySQL and the other databases are optimized for.
Okay.
That's how they just computing worked back in the day. We optimize for you can have as many concurrent requests as possible as your hardware supports.
Ah.
If they take a bit longer, they're still pretty fast, but they might take a little bit longer, but you can have 10,000, 100,000 concurrent requests. We don't care.
So rather than having a knee in the curve as more requests come in, each request becomes progressively and exponentially slower, you're aiming more for a linear path there.
Correct.
Where it's just the whole thing kind of scales nicely to 10 and 100 and 1,000 requests at a time.
That's basically how Erlang works.
Okay, very cool.
Yeah.
That's going to be really interesting to put that out in some interesting sites. Now,
what's
the development status now? Are we at a crossroads here? Are we about to release something or already has released? Or
There are releases. The 0.8 release is, I think, 4 weeks old now.
Okay, so you're still under one, though.
We are still under one.
Okay.
And we are traditional software developers, so we have the alpha label.
Okay.
Not in the way that nothing works, but in the way that we just don't have all the features in that we won't have for 1.0.
And you probably still reserve the right to change a few things before the
release. We reserve the right to change a lot of things.
Okay, yeah.
The things that are in, though, are pretty stable already. Like I made a little discussion forum demo on CouchDB and just let it run on one of my servers. And at some point, spammers picked that up and used it pretty heavily.
Wow.
And there was never any problem with that.
Wow.
In the 2 years I've been working with CouchDB, there were two reports of where data could be corrupted. But that were very rare edge cases that they people that these people tried to happen to find. There were no there are other bugs in there, but there's no like the data storage is very solid.
So do you have a timeline for a 1.0 release?
Yeah, we plan to have it at the end of the summer. That would be the probably the 0.9 release, and towards the end of the year would be 1.0. That's probably not when we get authentication.
Yeah.
And we just reserve the right to not do that.
And that's the end of 2008.
Yes.
Because, you know, some people just say end of the year and they mean whatever you're
going
to
mean. Yeah, whatever. No, it's end of this year.
Okay, good. Yes, we'll have it in fourth quarter, but they don't tell you what year.
Yeah.
Okay, very cool. And you'll be working heavily as one of the developers to help produce this.
Yeah, I'll do that and do a lot of community kind of things, like answering email on the mailing list and connecting developers and helping people get into the code. And
do you have a public bug tracker that people can post bugs to, or is it just handled in casually yet?
No, there's the Apache Software Foundation has a complete infrastructure.
Oh, great. And so that's one of the things you got by being part of Apache Software Foundation, you get all this infrastructure.
Yeah. We were on Google Code before, so
that's not I had that as well. Yeah. Is there anything that the ASF asks of you in this project, or they kind of just leave you alone?
They ask, there's this organization called Incubator within the Apache Software Foundation.
Okay.
That's where all the new projects get in. They incubate to become a top-level Apache project. And there are a couple of things you need to follow to graduate, to become a full a top-level project.
They have to, like, pass a test.
Yeah, sort of like that.
Okay.
They are very keen on community diversity.
Okay.
So you better get a couple more developers on it that you they basically look if your project's in a healthy state.
Right. It's not a one-man project for its own use.
No, not one company project.
Yeah.
But the project itself has some form of life.
And this at this point, you're probably on track of becoming a full-fledged Apache project then.
Very much. We've got a very very lively community. We could use a little help from a couple of Erlang developers.
So that's what you're looking for? Yeah, because you're talking to at least a few thousand people are listening to this right now.
If you know Erlang and CouchDB sounds cool, and if it doesn't, it is really cool, believe me. And do have a look. Come with hash CouchDB on Freenode. They're the mailing list that you can find on the website. Just join us, ask where you can help out.
If you don't know Erlang, can you go through that same, was it 1 or 2 week process that you went through to kind of get your head around it?
Yeah, that would work.
Okay.
And you don't. There are areas in the project. Like, if you like to document things, that would be nice.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's the state of the documentation? If I come in, is it all still just notes, or is there actually something?
No, we've got a wiki that explains most of the things very briefly. So people can work with that, but you can always improve documentation.
And you also want people that would be potentially users to come along to give you feedback then about where it's going?
Yes, and please, already made a request to the mailing list a couple of weeks ago, but if you've got a success story on CouchDB, we would very much like to hear about it.
Sure.
Like, what did you do to make it successful? Did you hit any roadblocks that we can put away for you? These kind of things.
Well, that's very cool. Well, Jan, I really want to thank you for taking your time out. Is there anything else you want to tell our audience before we let you get back to the conference? Yes.
Oh, I can't think of anything right now.
Well, very good. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And where can people go for further information about this? What's the URL?
Couchdb.org. Oh, I've got one thing to say.
Sure. Okay,
the people might wonder why it's called CouchDB.
Sure. I should have asked that.
It's kind of, I think they called it a backronym. Like, there was the name, and then we... Damien looked how to make sense of that. And it stands for Cluster of Unreliable Commodity Hardware.
Ah.
So bad.
That's very good. But is there a logo that has a couch in it? Or?
Yes, very sharp guy sitting on a very bright red couch.
And you realize that we have a street, we call it Couch Street here, but it's just a street that's spelled couch.
I've been there.
So you should take a picture of yourself. Okay, very good. I was going to say that would be really obvious and really natural for you.
I'm not in the picture, but I took a picture.
Oh, there you go. Very nice. And you can put that on some blog post.
Yes, I will do that.
That'll be very fun. Well, again, Jan, thank you for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.